All right, all you movie junkies, it is time for the SLS Cast with your hosts, Matt and Tim.
And welcome one and all to episode 29 of the SLS Cast, the episode that, unlike Joey's broken deal with God, that is Joey from Friends, we will go past the number 29. I am your host, Matt.
And as your other host, I am Tim.
Yes, and you are Tim. So, how you been doing, sir?
I'm doing well, and I am Tim. That I just kind of sounded a little mental there a bit.
That's okay. I am Sean Tim. Penn can do a movie called I Am Sam. You can get a podcast episode called I Am Tim.
Well, good. I think right off the bat, we got the name of this episode, I Am Tim.
Outstanding. I love it. So you were, you know, this is the post-vacation episode for you, sir.
Yes.
How was the Aloha visit?
The Aloha visit was a success. I'm bronze. I am currently the color of my of the table I am podcasting on right now. I am shimmering and golden sand colored skin. By God, should you be feeling it radiating through this microphone and penetrating your ears, this bronzing, glowing body of mine.
My cup is already yellow.
Oh, man. I should be a superhero character, the bronzing boy.
No, I'm going to go with no.
No.
Let's go with not.
No. But it was a fun trip. I had an excellent time. I almost got eaten by a shark, so that was always exciting. For now, I am able, and throughout my lifetime, I've almost been eaten by a shark, I've almost been eaten by an alligator, and I've gotten thrown off a car, so I really can't wait to see what else my life has in store for me.
Man, you've definitely done some fun things.
I have. Well, they were all unintentional.
I've been thrown from a moving car once, like, you know, the whole, just the same way that they always do in the mobster movies and stuff, when the guy owes him money, so they're roughing him up, and then they throw him from the car out on the side. That, I've done that before.
You got roughed up?
Well, it was kind of a joke that went awry, and it ultimately led to me getting tossed from a moving vehicle.
I never...
See, we all have just strange and wonderful stories of our lives and mistreatment of our bodies, don't we, Tim?
Yeah, but I mean, the mob isn't after me. I just went snorkeling and was told that, oh, go to Black Rock, you know, that's the best place to snorkel for free. And to all those that are planning on going to Hawaii anytime soon or in the future, never pay to snorkel, because there are a plethora of bays and beaches that you can go snorkeling in for free. All you have to do is just rent your own snorkeling gear. And that's what I was going to do. And there's this place called Black Rock that is a black rock, to say the least, that my girlfriend Chelsea and her parents have gone snorkeling in the many times that they would come and visit Maui. So we go out there, and, you know, it's about 7:30 in the morning, 8 o'clock in the morning, and the waves are kind of churning. It really wasn't the best snorkeling time to go snorkeling. I mean, it wasn't the best snorkeling conditions to go snorkeling, and I didn't know that at the time because I've never gone snorkeling before, so my life was basically in the hands of my girlfriend and her mother, which I've come to the conclusion might not have been the best idea for me to place my life within their hands, because by the time we got out there, we were a good 10-minute swim back to the beach. Do you ever snorkel, Matt? Have you ever snorkeled in your life?
I have. I know that I don't do it anymore, but I grew up in the tropics and in Florida and all that good stuff, so yes, I have done definitely my fair share of snorkeling.
Did you have any, like, snorkel issues, like with your mask fogging up or falling off or taking in water or anything like that?
No. I actually, growing up in that environment, I learned very early on how to take a deep breath above water so that you could dive with the snorkel, and then you're holding that deep breath, and then when you pop back up, you can just go level with your head, the snorkel pops out, and then you just do a big pah, you know, when you're exhaling, and it shoots the water out, and then you just can breathe. Also, you can pull your mask, like, off of the top, if it's fogging up and stuff, you can kind of pull your mask away so that it fills with water, but you do it from the eyebrow level,
mm-hmm.
and then right as you're doing it, give a big hard with your nose, and the air bubbles push the water back out so that your mask doesn't have a problem.
See, I did not know that. And so I met this cove, and my mask is, like, effing up, and I finally get everything adjusted, and everything's fitting properly, and I look down and I see through the murky water some really pretty fish, the Ahumanitata, Kumanitata fish, or whatever it's called, the fish of Maui or Hawaii was there. And I'm having a good time, and as I'm in the water, I suddenly hear my girlfriend, who is about 20 feet away, just start splashing around and just swimming away. And again, still in the water, I hear her mom say, "Out of the water! I saw something big! I saw something big in the water!" You know, she's trying not to, like, alert us. And she's trying so hard not to say shark, until maybe 10 seconds later, she just blurts out, "Shark! Shark!" And so I start, not freaking out, but kind of like, you know, doing the thing like, okay, well, I really need to get back to shore. So I have a little floaty thing with me because it's my first time out there. Shit was kind of unadjusted, so I need the floaty thing to help me keep up and maneuver and adjust anything as I needed it to be adjusted. And it was taking me forever to get out of harm's way. And I just kind of gave up at one point to where I thought, well, if a shark was going to eat me, he probably would have already have eaten me by now, or have already bit me by now. So for a good, like, 3 minutes, I kind of just stayed there and was just ready to, like, take off my snorkel and jab it in shark eye. I mean, I was just set and I was ready to go. We all made it safely to the beach. It was a little too tense.
So you think maybe that if you're wanting to avoid a shark, perhaps at that point it is okay to pay to snorkel?
Possibly, yeah, because there's somebody there. Or go to, like, Honolulu Bay, which is a very pretty bay, where you just go maybe 10 feet off the beach, and there's coral right there. And that's very safe, because you're not going that far off the beach itself into the water. But I suggest that, other than swimming out to a cove and hanging out by Black Rock or anything like that.
I, on the other hand, had a pretty uneventful week. I had my birthday yesterday. And so I am now officially 36.
Oh, well.
And it was pretty quiet, just kind of stayed at home, did the home family thing. And it was okay. I had a buddy of mine, my best friend Rob, came over, and he presented me with some new additions to my Arkham Horror game. So now I've got 4 of the expansions for this game, 4 of the 8 expansions. And then we had a wonderful homemade dinner cooked by my awesome wife, and culminated the evening with talk and discussion of Final Fantasy XIV. It's the reboot of an online MMO that Square Enix is trying again for. And then we actually watched some Extreme Couponers.
Actual show?
The actual show, Extreme Couponers. Or Extreme Couponing, or whatever the heck it is on TLC. That's right. I'm super cool. Yes,
so do you watch Extreme Couponers? Do you read that microwave kitchen book that you were telling us about a few episodes back?
No, it is strangely addictive, this show. My wife started watching this show, and thankfully it's only 30 minutes, so you can blow through a whole season in about 2.5 hours or something, because there's only like 8 or 9 episodes, and then of course they take the commercials out, so you're looking at like 21 minutes. And it's pretty interesting. This particular season, they're bringing back the top savers, people who spent, oh, I don't know, the retail value of their groceries was in the neighborhood of like $1,800, and yet they didn't pay but like $3. These people are like insane with their coupons, and they're having them compete against each other.
Next, so on TLC. Extreme Couponing.
Exactly. Sunday, Sunday, Sunday.
Get the whole season on Blu-ray, DVD, 2.5 hours of extreme couponing.
Exactly. It's pretty cool. I gotta say, you know, I did enjoy it. I do get sucked into it. I would not go out of my way to watch it, but given that it was just across the room and Rob and I just kind of drifted over and looked and like, huh, that's kind of interesting. And then we ended up sitting down and watching it. Yeah, we're cool. I did, however, go to a pretty bitchin' housewarming party the previous weekend where got nice and toasty with some friends I hadn't seen for a while, and that was a lot of fun.
When you say toasty, you don't mean like sexy or anything. Like, you didn't go and have a big orgy at this house party. And by house party, you actually mean a house party, not a...
It was a housewarming party, so it was truly a house party.
Well, I didn't know what you meant by toasty, if you meant by... It could be a few things, like you ate a lot of toast there, like you made toast at the housewarming party, or it was toasty, like warm,
drunk.
Or, oh,
was,
drunk.
I was just trying to say it nicely. Got drunk. I discovered Bacardi and Fresca, and the only thing better than that is Don Julio and Fresca. It's amazing. Fresca is like an extremely all-purpose citrusy drink, citrusy soda, that by itself is not really all that good, but when you put alcohol in it, it becomes amazing. Truly amazing. That was the entirety of my week.
Pretty eventful.
For both of us, apparently.
Yeah.
A little bit of drinking, a little bit of almost dying. Hey, you know, par for the course for us, right?
I know, exactly. A little bit of drinking, a little bit of death. Tune in to the SLS cast.
Right on. So then I guess, should we go ahead and get straight into the good stuff?
Yes, we shall.
Then let us do the news. Well, you were gone last week, so why don't we go ahead and have you kick off the news so that we can bring you back in and absorb your golden bronzeness, whatever, through our speakers as you emanate it through your microphone.
Everybody put on your bronzing glasses and just look at a picture of me and get the full effect. I only have a few bits of news pieces to share with you guys today, since Matt has a plethora of news. Therefore, we shall disperse the news in equal amounts, or at least try to. My first bit of news is Jim Carrey news. And Jim Carrey, as at least I would think a number of us movie fanatics know, he will be in the sequel of Kick-Ass, where he will be playing General Stars and Stripes. And for those of you who do not know, Kick-Ass is a rated R superhero comedy. Hard R, a lot of action, a lot of violence, a lot of language, and all the above. However, Jim Carrey recently tweeted, as recent as June 23rd at 12:33 p.m., saying, "I did Kick-Ass a month before Sandy Hook, and now in all good conscience, I cannot support that level of violence. My apologies." Then he retweets later on saying, "I meant to say my apologies to others involved with the film. I'm not ashamed of it, but recent events have caused a change in my heart." So it's a very violent film, and because of Sandy Hook happening, I guess after he did the movie, he's kind of going away from supporting the film. I mean, he's not saying that he's glad he did the movie, and I guess he had a good experience, according to what I've read beforehand. It's just because of the turn of events and the violence that have happened within the recent months, he just doesn't approve of himself being involved with a movie that shows people trying to kill kids, a young girl who I guess she's in her mid-teens now, killing adults, using guns, using doing violence and all that stuff because of events in the Boston Marathon and all that. So I thought that was pretty interesting that Jim Carrey does stick to his morals. I mean, he does do raunchy comedy a lot. He's done many raunchy comedic movies. But regardless of what one thinks about movies directly affecting violence in our everyday life, I would hope that everybody can kind of give Jim Carrey some props, sticking with his morals, sticking with his beliefs and feelings on this issue. In other Jim Carrey news, Dumb and Dumber 2, which is the Dumb and Dumber sequel, has now been greenlit. It is currently going into production with Red Giant Pictures and Universal Studios. And for those of you who do not know, again, Dumb and Dumber 2, T.O., which it will be called, is about one of them, I guess, has a illegitimate child, and they're trying to go find their child to try to get one of their kidneys. And the whole idea of the movie is that these guys are still as dumb as they were in the first movie. They haven't gained any intellect or any smarts whatsoever. So I don't know about you, Matt, but I'm kind of both excited for this movie and not too sure about a sequel to Dumb and Dumber, because
I just want them to make up their goddamn minds. Do a sequel or don't.
Yeah.
I would like to see a sequel, but I only want to see a sequel if both of them are in it.
Right, exactly. And apparently they are going to be doing it. Jim Carrey will be in it and Jeff Daniels will be in it. Both will be reprising their roles. And they have secured production companies to both finance and distribute the movie into theaters. So,
yay!
You know, and unfortunately the Farley brothers haven't really fared too well with their last few movies, those being Movie 43, the Three Stooges movie, which had, you know, which was enjoyable to watch, but it was very problematic in itself as well. And honestly, really, their last really good movie they made, in my opinion, was Fever Pitch, and that's been nearly 10 years ago. So let's hope they'll pull it off with Dumb and Dumber 2. In other news, my last bit of news is Star Wars Episode 3, four, five, seven news. Star Wars Episode 7 news. Harrison Ford, Mark Hamill, and Carrie Fisher will be reprising their roles. And Disney has hired nutritional advisors, or I guess nutritionists, to work with Mark Hamill and to work with Carrie Fisher with losing weight. They're basically being put on a mad diet. As what Matt and I were talking about before the show and the pre-show, Mark Hamill actually looks pretty well for his age. However, that luck does not fare as well for Carrie Fisher. She kind of gained the poundage. She was mentally depressed for a long while and popping the pills and drinking the booze. So hopefully the sexiness, if not the buffness, will come back into play in the Star Wars Episode 7 film. And as we know from what Matt was talking about in a few episodes ago, that Harrison Ford does not need to take part in this diet. I mean, I'm going to speak for all the ladies here, not necessarily for myself, that Harrison Ford still looks pretty damn good. He looks like he can kick my ass, at least, which I guess I don't know if that really says much, but he can kick anybody's ass. Still, he can kick a young guy's ass and succeed completely. So yes, in the future, we hope to see these people looking good in the upcoming Star Wars sequel.
Okay, so we'll go ahead and jump right into mine. First up, Steven Spielberg, struggling filmmaker. Yes, this here is from the Atlantic Wire. Okay, we have wonderful little Miss Abby Ohilheiser. And she says that of all the people to sound the alarm on the decline and fall of the film industry, Steven Spielberg might seem like an improbable choice. But the director, speaking with George Lucas at a ceremony celebrating the opening of a new building at University of Southern California's film school, said that an, quote, implosion, end quote, of his industry is inevitable. Spielberg's advice for the aspiring USC filmmakers was, well, straight out of a disaster film script. Quote, eventually going to be an implosion or a big meltdown. There's going to be an implosion where three or four or maybe even a half dozen mega budget movies are going to go crashing into the ground, and that's going to change the paradigm. End quote. This is all coming from a point where Spielberg had to essentially finance the production and distribution of Lincoln for himself. They are bringing this into the forefront. The article points out that it says, case in point for him, him being Spielberg, Lincoln, which was a commercial and critical success, was apparently almost an HBO exclusive. Quote, this close, ask HBO, this close, end quote. He said in response to Lucas's comment that, quote, eventually the Lincolns will go away and they're going to be on television, end quote. Spielberg, he said, only got the film into theaters in the first place because he basically owns his own infrastructure. The idea here is that studios are only going to do reboots, franchises, big budget stuff, and they're starting to drift more and more away from real storytelling. They figure that people who want real storytelling are just going to stay home and watch it on their TVs. And why should they waste anything to go on the big screen? I gotta say that while I agree with that sentiment, and not because I agree with it cynically, not that I'm happy about it. While I agree with that sentiment, I really don't think that it's such a bad thing. I think that when that crash happens, and I do see the crash, I believe that crash is coming. Yes, I think for probably a good decade, an easy decade, it's going to be hard times in the movie industry. I think that, yes, there's only going to be people who will back the absolute utmost surefire things. But I think that much like with the music video industry, you will see it become streamlined and you will see it become reasonable again. Back when videos, I allude to that because back when MTV first started, the budget for music videos was, I'm going to speculate with today's dollars instead of trying to deal with inflation and everything, your budget was probably $100,000. And then we saw that as videos really took off, that they would go into the millions and multi-millions. And you see Michael Jackson spending millions upon millions of dollars for computer animation technology that morphs him from a panther into a human. Or in the Remember the Time video where he spins and turns into glass, or not glass, but gold droplets and falls all over the ground and stuff. You have all those things going on. And then the paradigm changed where music was more about going onto the internet. And music revenues for the big record companies began to go down from their original standpoints because the media was changing. The medium was changing. People weren't just buying records and CDs anymore. People were starting to go and download and file share. And thankfully, iTunes came along and completely changed the industry with 99 cent songs. But when that started happening, people stopped watching MTV. MTV then starts switching into the reality TV format that we have today. It's not even called music television anymore. I don't even know what the fuck the M stands for. It's just MTV now. They do that because when that paradigm shift happened, nobody wanted to spend money to market musicians via music videos. So now music videos are getting posted on YouTube and people are spending sometimes as little as $1,000 or just what it was, just how much ever it cost for their software on their computer and however much they paid for their video camera. And now they're just doing all the digital stuff and everything on their computers here. And you see it starting to take off and you see so much more creativity and you see so many more things that people appreciate. And again, the really cool stuff still rises to the top. Took about 10 years. And I see that happening again in this particular instance. So I think that Spielberg is right. It's going to be harder to find the Lincolns, and it's going to be much easier to see the Avengers 27, so very tired. That's kind of how I see it, but eventually I think it will work itself back so that you can start seeing To Kill a Mockingbird again, that you can start seeing the really cool movie, End of Watch. Those kinds of movies will start to be really cool again.
Well, and especially with Spielberg's success with HBO, with doing like Band of Brothers, the John Adams miniseries, I find those kind of setups a lot more entertaining than some of the historical movies that I go to the movie theater to see. Because with miniseries or multiple movies on, you know, being shown on HBO about a particular time in history or a person in history, they have the ability to elaborate and extend the story and to go more in depth in the story, which I think lacks in many condensed versions of theatrical movies that pertain to historical moments of time. Unlike, you know, Lincoln, where Lincoln was about 3 hours long, but a lot of people that I've talked to that didn't want to go see the movie because they didn't want to sit through a movie, regardless of the accolades that the movie garnered, they didn't want to sit through that movie for more than 3 hours. I mean, even with The Hobbit, or even with Lord of the Rings, people still bitch about the running time. So I can see movies like that being shoved off the mainstream theatrical market and being put onto TV, especially since now TVs are getting bigger and home entertainments are becoming more of a hot commodity. However, I think there's definitely an importance to watching these movies at a movie theater. Because in a movie theater, unless you have an annoying person sitting by you, you cannot be bothered. You're secluded from the outside world, opposed to when you're at home, you have the ability to pause and stop a movie and come back to it later. Which, for most people, that ruins the flow of the movie. And it robs the director, and it robs the performances of the actors, and it even just robs the whole movie itself from a faithful viewing. So I really hope that these types of movies aren't going to get shunned away from the movie theater. I hope they stay there.
ComingSoon.net is already screaming of Man of Steel sequels. Now, people have already been going on. David Goyer has been on the record multiple times talking about what the future can hold for the characters. There was a Wall Street Journal article where Warner's president of domestic distribution, Dan Fellman, had this to say about the future. Quote, "It's more than just a franchise for us. It really opens up the door to do combinations of the DC Comics characters. We can build them up like Marvel did and benefit from the history of DC," end quote. They are trying to use this as a springboard for everything. And in doing so, get this, folks, it was reported last week that a Man of Steel sequel is in the works, and the latest report via the Wall Street Journal is that the sequel is being fast-tracked to accommodate a 2014 release. Furthermore, quote, "knowledgeable people close to the studio," end quote, also told the Wall Street Journal that a, quote, "Justice League," end quote, film could come out, quote, "as soon as 2015," end quote. Good lord.
Yikes.
Is 2014 too soon for a Man of Steel sequel?
Yes.
I have to agree. I mean, I don't know. I suppose maybe Christmas of 2014 would probably be the earliest that I think that I could get around to seeing it. I think that if you rush this stuff, you're gonna cause fatigue. People aren't going to want to see the movie because there's too many to go and see.
Yeah, and it's different from like Harry Potter, because you had the last Harry Potter movie being released within, I think, 6 months apart?
Yes. It was either November or December and then
July. Yeah, because that was a continuation of a story, of one story.
Correct.
So unless the sequel isn't going to be not as much of a special effects heavy movie, or I can see the possibility, but I would just be worried that the story would be too thin and didn't have enough time to be read by the proper people and to be dissected by the proper people. And it just kind of sounds like a money grab for the studio to even think about doing that.
I have to agree. But again, it goes back to that first story. Kind of, they're starting to jam it down everybody's throats. Oh, we think we've got something to work with here. We'll see what happens. Only time will tell. Next up, also Man of Steel related, and I'm going to advise you now, spoiler alert, so give this about a minute and a half and skip ahead about a minute or two, alright? Man of Steel, Christopher Nolan opposed the ending DC Comics advised on it. This is coming from comicbook.com by Russ Burlingame. Here's the gist. David S. Goyer revealed that producer Christopher Nolan was opposed to the controversial ending to Man of Steel. This was in an interview with Empire Magazine, the Empire Magazine podcast. This is what he said. Quote, "Killing Zod was a big thing, and Chris Nolan originally said there's no way you can do this," end quote. Quote, "There was a change. Originally, Zod got sucked into the Phantom Zone along with the others, and I just felt it was unsatisfying, and so did Zack. We started questioning. We talked to some of the people at DC Comics and said, do you think there is ever a way that Superman would kill someone? And at first they said, no way, no way. And we said, but what if he didn't have a choice? Originally, Chris didn't even want to let us try to write it. And Zack and I said, we think we can figure out a way that you'll buy it." End quote. I gotta say, I thought that this was a brilliant move on their part, and I think that the final, I'm gonna skip a whole lot of this. I think that the bulk of this is right in that first sentence. That if you force his hand, especially in a first time out scenario, you leave it open. And I will go to this and say, this is the final quote from the article. Quote, "I think that when you really put in stone the notion that he won't kill, it erases an option in the viewer's mind. That doesn't mean that he doesn't now have a code. I just won't do that. I have to find another way," end quote. I thought that it was really cool. All of the people in the theater, there was an audible gasp when he did it. And I thought it was definitely one of the higher points of the flick, because it wasn't even about it's him or me. This was about it's him or everyone else. And he made the tough choice. After everything that he tried to do, he had to make the tough choice, and I think that it was the right choice, personally. But I thought it was really good that he pulled it off. And I thought it was a well-done move for Supes to kill Zod. And without going too much into the rest of the movie, where do you find yourself on this one? Specifically just the killing of Zod.
I'll just say that if I had to accept everything that was going on during the last 25, 30 minutes of the movie, I think it was well fit.
So it fit the narrative of what you were watching.
Yes, what I was exposed to. Yes, it fit. Yeah, it fit the because that was the only thing that could really make sense in the moment.
Guys, this is the short version of, because there was a lot of controversy about it, but this is kind of giving you an idea of where he was going with it and briefly explaining why it's important to have such an option on the table and for you to see it. Especially since it's never explained before. Now you've kind of got a concrete idea of why, going forward, he may never kill again. But that it's not something that's not a line that could never have been crossed once before. So there you go, there's that. Next up, from BleedingCool.com, Star Wars Episode 7 Character Details. This is coming from Brendan Connolly. Says that, quote, "We've got our hands on the first real casting breakdowns of characters from the next Star Wars movie. What's more, we've verified that these are lead characters, though not necessarily to be billed in the order below. I want to stress, Bleeding Cool have 100% confirmed that the following is accurate and that the open casting started today in the UK. This is coming from June 19th. All right. And that's end quote. Sorry, that's end quote. Including all of the grammatical errors that I just read. Do know how to talk, I promise. Turns out they're looking for a late teen female, independent, good sense of humor, fit. Young 20-something male, witty and smart, fit, but not traditionally good-looking. A late 20-something male, fit, handsome, and confident. 70-something male with strong opinions and tough demeanor, also doesn't need to be particularly fit. A second young female, also late teens, tough, smart, and fit. 40-something male, fit, military type. 30-something male, intellectual, apparently doesn't need to be fit. Those are the character things there, and I don't know, I'm already starting to put pictures in my head here. And he closes out the article by saying, quote, but seeing as they're looking for two teenage girls, chances are that, chances are that rumor about a teenage female lead has something to it, end quote. So this is going to be a very interesting cast, especially if they're having to put the oldies but goodies on diets. So there you go. These are the first glimmers of Star Wars news.
Star Wars first class.
Yeah, see, exactly. Star Wars the freshman years. There you go. All right, next up, in Rome. This comes to us from the AP by Nicole Winfield, as reported by MSN Entertainment. Some sad news. This is in relation to James Gandolfini. It turns out that in Rome, a friend of Soprano star James Gandolfini said Thursday the actor was discovered by a family member in his hotel room in Rome before he was pronounced dead of cardiac arrest at a hospital. Michael Kobold, who described himself as a close family friend, read a short statement to reporters but said little more about the circumstances of Gandolfini's death on Wednesday night. He did not say who discovered Gandolfini, 51, but NBC quoted Antonio De Amore, manager of the Basculo Excedra Hotel, as saying it was the actor's 13-year-old son, Michael. That's terrible. He was pronounced dead at 11 p.m. Wednesday in Rome, and an autopsy would be performed. Now, this is, again, this is coming straight. This is from the day he died. This is from June 20th. It's basically cardiac arrest. This is why you see a lot of big guys and you see a lot of old guys, but you don't necessarily see a lot of older big guys. And the thing was, this was very sudden. He was actually there to receive an award and take part in closing ceremony for the Terramina Film Festival. He was also going to be giving a class last Saturday morning. He was supposed to be giving a special class at the festival. So, I mean, it just goes to show you, you are not promised anything. And he definitely did a lot. He parlayed his success from The Sopranos and did a lot of work with the troops. He was definitely very active there. He was active in the USO, and his particular champion cause was PTSD, and really brought that to the forefront and really made sure that people understood what war was like and why our soldiers, when they come home, a lot of them are acting the way that they're acting. And he was doing a lot of good work, and it's very sad, especially when you know he had a kid as young as 13.
Is it bad that whenever I think of USO, I still think of Bob Hope and tap dancers? So for some reason, just you said James Gandolfini involved with the USO, I just pictured him like tap dancing on stage and like holding a golf club and saying,
you know,
Weisbrax.
I think it really keeps me hopeful that I know we're only 11 years apart and everything, but that decade can really mean a lot to a lot of people. It means a lot that you at 25 still know and understand who Bob Hope was, because I can tell you, if we put you in a room with 10 of with 9 of the 25-year-olds, chances are you're the only one who's going to know who Bob Hope was.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Again, it's just very sad. James Gandolfini did pass. So long, Tony. We'll miss you. And I guess we'll go ahead and jump in. He was not the only person who passed away. 4 days later, we received news that Richard Matheson died. Richard Matheson, he was the man who initially did the work I Am Legend. This one particular story spawned The Last Man on Earth, The Omega Man, I Am Legend with Will Smith, and inspired Night of the Living Dead. Okay, he also wrote Hell House, which was the diving board for movies, as well as the for many Haunted House movies, as well as the adaptation of The Legend of Hell House. He also penned What Dreams May Come and many Twilight Zone episodes. We lost some pretty amazing people in the last couple of weeks. But like other things, we all must go forward. And in going forward, we discover that Sony and Disney begin streaming movies still in theaters in a bold move against piracy. This comes to us from TheVerge.com, and this is by Matt Bryan. The idea here is that, basically, in a bid to limit movie piracy in Asia, Disney and Sony have quietly begun testing a bold new on-demand service in South Korea, which offers movies to rent while they are still playing in theaters. This was noted by the Wall Street Journal that the two companies are the first U.S. studios to provide consumers anywhere with the option to buy a ticket to see a movie or watch it in their own home using their cable, internet, or satellite TV subscription. Django Unchained, Wreck-It Ralph, and Brave had all been made available as part of the trial. What do you think of this?
Well, I think they're going to be starting to do that here in the U.S. a lot more. I mean, they've been doing it with... You'll see a lot of movies that have been released on video on demand like a month before they release into theaters, especially with a lot of these lower budget movies. Like there's this, I think it's called VHS and VHS 2, this low budget anthology horror movie. And, you know, you can rent it on the TV and it'll be available for like limited release in a month, or it's already come out for limited release. I'm not too sure. So I think it's just the change in the entertainment industry and how we watch movies. I mean, soon, kind of like what we were talking about earlier with all these movies that, and all these miniseries that HBO and Showtime are able to do that movie studios and directors cannot do with a theatrical movie because of time restrictions and limited audience interest. So, you know, I just think it's just a new step, and I don't know if that's a good thing or not. It could also be they're trying to show these movies to get the Chinese audience or the foreign audience to become more interested in watching American movies, especially watching particular American movies that they wouldn't be interested in watching, like Quentin Tarantino movies or any of these other lesser known movies that from their eye they're lesser known. So, I mean, I think it's just like a big marketing ploy to get them to go to the movie theater more, because with what they did with Iron Man 2, also with what we're finding out with Transformers, is that Transformers is being filmed in China. And because they're wanting to get money from China, to get China to fund the movie and to use locations in the movie, the Chinese government, or the Chinese whatever, basically said that China has to have a big part in the movie. Basically, China has to be an unspoken character in the movie. So the movie is now going to have to cater towards the Chinese market completely. So China is actually taking over Transformers. And with Iron Man 3, since they were wanting to appeal more to the Chinese demographic, they had to incorporate Chinese actors for these random shoo-in scenes that were comprised of these major Chinese stars, just so that the Chinese market will go out and see the movie because there is something they can relate to. So I think all that kind of just ties in together, you know, just a big marketing ploy to get more of the Chinese dollars and more of the Chinese people to go and watch movies that they might not really go and watch on their own.
I have to say that this is probably more of a bid to try and integrate the any money is better than no money scenario. I think that it does kind of work, not quite to pandering more or less to the Chinese so much as where you were initially going with that, with if we make, say, every third movie available for rent at the same time, it will entice people like, oh, well, this is the kind of stuff they're showing in the movies now, in the theaters nowadays. It might be worth going to the theater to go check out some other movies. I could see it kind of feeding in that way, where not every movie gets to be released simultaneously or a couple of weeks after it's in the theater. It's already available for rent online to stream or what have you.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think that it does kind of entice people to say, look, see, we've got cool stuff. Come and see the rest of the cool stuff at the theater. So, and in the process, they still make some money.
Right.
These are people who might have pirated the movie otherwise or watched it for free at somebody's house and like, hey, well, this is a movie I don't have to pay $10 for. I'll pay $4 and my family can watch it now. And like, oh, wow, this stuff's really cool. Well, let's go see the rest of the Pixar movies at the movie theater. I can see them doing that. And I think the closing of the article here is really telling. It says that as the world's eighth largest film market, South Korea is a good place for Disney and Sony to start. Should they test the model outside of Asia, both companies will likely be met with greater opposition in countries like the US and UK. With movies like Iron Man 3 performing fantastically at the US box office with a $175 million opening weekend, second only to the Avengers, theaters play a major part in building buzz for a title. That said, the four other major Hollywood studios are said to be watching the situation closely and may follow suit, putting pressure on movie theater chains and the future of the exclusive 90-day play window in the U.S. I think that's what it's coming down to, is that do we say, can the theaters survive if they don't have 3 months to play these movies, or up to 3 months to play these movies, where you can't get them any other way? Or do we again say, well, no, we're trying to entice them to come to the theater more by kind of the breadcrumb approach, and you catch more flies with honey than vinegar. I think that's kind of where they're going with it. I personally don't see a problem with it. I think if it's a movie that I really want to see, I'm going to go to the theater and see it regardless.
Exactly.
I think that if it's a movie that I'm so much on the fence about that they're willing to let me see it at home for $4 or $5 instead of driving and paying 10, I'll give them my $4 or $5.
Right. And one other thing that it kind of brings up is piracy. Like, will that make piracy a little bit easier for people to somehow feed the what's happening on their TV onto their computer and somehow capture it? That'll be very interesting.
Course. Absolutely. Absolutely. So, given that we're done with the news, I believe it is now time for... Yes, Three Squared. This week's Three Squared, your favorite movie opening. And since you started the news, Tim, I'm going to go ahead and jump right in here with my Three Squared, if that's okay.
Sure, go for it.
All right, let's do it. You're going to sense a theme here by the time I'm done with my Three Squared. And these are not, for me, these are not the end-all, be-all of movie openings, but I gotta say that since at least one of them was something that Tim picked and he got his picks in first, I had to do a little bit of scrambling today when I was looking over the emails. They're not my end-all be-all, but these are definitely up in my top three. They're the echelon of greatness, and they came to the forefront first. This is not to say that there will never be another good one or that there aren't other good ones, but man, these are just right in my face, so I'm bringing them up. First one, in no particular order, The Last of the Mohicans, 1992 film, directed by Michael Mann, starring Daniel Day-Lewis and Madeleine Stowe. Now, this is one there, we're talking about the French and the Indian War. This is back in 1757, okay? We've got a little bit of a setup here where we've got Mohican Chingangchuk is meeting with his sons, Uncas, and adopted white Nathaniel Hawkeye. They are visiting some friends and stuff. They get together and they're heading home at the same time that newly arrived Major Duncan Hayward and his Huron guide Magua are tasked with escorting some, or basically are they're tasked with bringing back some of another guy. His name is Colonel Edmund Monroe. They're bringing back Monroe's daughter, okay? So they kind of come across one another as Magua has led the group into an ambush by his Huron party, where Hawkeye, Uncas, and Chingangchuk save them. And this thing is just one of the most epic battles I've ever seen. I really think, for me, they did a good job of showing what Indian warfare looked like then. This was something that was eventually picked up and used by what we would now turn as the Americans by the time of the Revolutionary War, because it was guerrilla war tactics. The tribes were like the Mohicans, right? And the Hurons They were like, why in the hell would anybody just march out into a field and start shooting at one another? You're very likely to die that way. It seems to me that if you're going to go and attack somebody, you need to attack them when they least suspect it, or you're going to attack them from hidden positions and positions of strength, which is what they did. They would hide behind trees, they would, you know, jump out at people, and this is how they do the attack. So not only are you seeing something that's pretty cool from a historical aspect, and I'm not saying they got everything right, I mean, this is still a movie after all, but it was just really interesting to finally see something that interesting. And then, of course, you get to see Daniel Day-Lewis being a badass and all that kind of stuff, and it was really cool. And to this day, okay, 1992, 21 years ago, it still is indelible in my mind. Next up, speaking of moving through trees and attacking people, The Patriot, the 2000 film by Roland Emmerich. All right, you know, the guy from Independence Day in 2012 and The Day After Tomorrow and White House Down. This guy likes to blow up the Eastern Seaboard. I don't know what the hell this problem is, but he always does the Eastern Seaboard. Maybe he doesn't like it very much. We have an opening here where this is during the American Revolution of 1776. We've got a young man, well, not a young man, he's just a father, played by Mel Gibson. And he is trying to keep his children because he knows of how bad things were, like during the French and Indian War. He understands just exactly what warfare really is. He doesn't want any part of it, and he just wants peace. And unfortunately, and so as the movie opens, they're setting the stage for all these things happening and what's going on in the Americas today. And it all explodes right at the time that you get Colonel William Tavington, who's played by Jason Isaacs, and one of the best villains, like, ever. Comes in, essentially, and basically through somewhat of a misunderstanding, but it doesn't matter because he's just an asshole anyway, he kills one of Mel Gibson's kids. And so he has to go and attack him. And this is all within, like, the first 10 minutes of the movie. They've gone and set this up and paced it really well so that all of a sudden you're just going, boom! And he goes, and Mel Gibson becomes the ghost because he seemingly kills an entire company of men single-handed. And it's just fantastic to watch. Again, taking advantage, attacking from the trees, shooting all over the place, and then beating people to death with tomahawks and all that kind of stuff. It was just, God, it's just amazing. Again, fantastic opening. It's kind of like setting up all these different aspects to a story, and then all of a sudden just, boom, hits you with ultra violence all like within the first 10 minutes. Last but not least, a movie known for its family-friendly content, Kill Bill Volume 1. This is where we start. This is the ultimate revenge flick. And it is essentially, Part 1 is definitely more violent than Part 2. And this is a movie that opens with an intertitle displaying the proverb, revenge is a dish best served cold, where it then cuts to more or less a flashback of a pregnant woman lying badly wounded at her wedding, telling an unseen Bill that she is carrying his baby as Bill shoots her in the head. And she manages to live. And that's just the first 35 seconds of the movie. Then you get the full opening, well, you know, 10-12 minutes here, where you get the best badass that comes back, which is actually, it's told out of order, which is an amazing thing, where the bride has come for her second revenge killing. But it's shown at the beginning, again, out of order. This is very Quentin Tarantino, because again, this is a Quentin Tarantino movie, sorry. Forgot to throw that out there if you didn't know already. Where she comes and finds Vernita Green at her home and fights her, and they just go through the whole house, and there's sword play and knifing and gunfire and shots, and a little girl's a witness, and man, cereals everywhere. It's just fantastic. And that's just like, first 10 minutes, you get to see all this badass stuff. So, as you can see, I like movies that are wholesome, that do not contain violence, that are very good for the soul, that you could show at church. My favorite openings, my Three Squared, The Last of the Mohicans, 1992 film, The Patriot 2000, and Kill Bill Volume 1 from 2003.
I'm just glad you stuck with the same rating as rated G for all those movies.
Yes, I thought that if I'm going to go with family-friendly entertainment, I should at least maintain the same rating across all three movies.
I know. He did a well job. I'm glad none of those were too violent. It didn't show any blood whatsoever. Now, the epitome of opening movies, like the opening scene of a movie, I think is kind of like Citizen Kane. I mean, you talk to any film aficionado, current, past, whatever, they say Citizen Kane with the whole death of Kane and the Rosebud, and all that whole schlock. I mean, that is apparently one of the best opening 5 minutes of any film whatsoever. So going off that, my three favorite, and I also have a bonus one that I originally was going to put in my top three, but because I keep talking about this movie so much, I felt obligated to leave it out my, you know, original top three. So my first one is from 2011, and it's the film Drive with Ryan Gosling. This is a phenomenal opening to a movie. There's no other movie since 2011 that opened up with music and cinematography that goes well with the movie. I mean, it sets up the movie, it sets up the tone of the movie perfectly, it sets up the character who's the mysterious driver played by Ryan Gosling, who is a stuntman who is hired by various crooks and thieves to be their getaway driver. So the opening is him getting a call and then going on a drive for these burglars that are robbing, I don't know, some store or whatever. And it's him driving through LA, outrunning the cops and outrunning the helicopters with the spotlights. And it's just a heart-pounding thrill ride. Elegantly edited, elegantly shot. And again, the soundtrack, which is the Chromatics, Tick of the Clock. It's phenomenal. Definitely, you guys have to check it out. Preferably on a big screen and with the sound cranked up. So again, Drive from 2011, and that cinematographer is Newton Thomas Siegel. Phenomenal cinematography, and I just love how he set up LA as a character in the movie. It's not just a setting, and I think it goes to say, like, if a cinematographer does its job, if you're watching a movie, and what he is shooting, what he is filming, how he sets up the camera brings out that object. It can be an inanimate object or even a setting. And it creates a character. You know, it coincides with the moment beautifully that if he got one little thing wrong, it would have ruined the entire movie. I mean, that's how flawless I think this opening is. The second movie on my list is The Matrix. Now, this opening properly sets up what you are in store for not only the first movie, but the two sequels that follow. Within the first 5, 6, 7, 8, 10 minutes of the movie, you see people defying gravity with leaps and weaponry. You see phenomenal green, grainy, film noir-esque cinematography and excellent stunt work and gun work. Bill Pope did the cinematography. He did an excellent job since The Matrix, or actually before The Matrix, pre-The Matrix. Nothing else can be compared to this style, this look, the texture of the movie. I mean, it's definitely a film noir. He definitely pulled from The Maltese Falcons and all the movies from the 40s, 30s, even the 50s. And it's phenomenal. This kind of coincides with my bonus movie, as well as another movie that I'll mention a little bit later, called Dark City. Alex Poyas' Dark City, who he also did The Crow, which is another visually, stylistically entertaining movie, that the movie, especially The Matrix, would not be The Matrix if it wasn't for the atmosphere and the cinematography and the setup that the opening scenes of that movie provides to the viewer. I mean, it's just phenomenal. You got the excellent music, you got the what the hell's going on, you have the people flying around, jumping from rooftop to rooftop, you have people getting shot in the face, you have a guy getting shot, falling to the ground, and then regenerating into another version of himself. I mean, it's just a fantastical opening to a movie. And then my third and final movie, before I mention my bonus movie, is There Will Be Blood. Now, the opening of this movie is very quiet, other than the haunting score of the movie. It's very quiet. I mean, there's opening shots of the West. I believe this is shots that were filmed in Marfa, Texas, so I guess West, Northwest Texas. Beautiful shots of landscape, and it also debuts the character of Daniel Plainview. And again, there is no talking, it's only this music, the striking violins, and he is going down into a mine. He falls down the mine, and the character's psyche kind of comes out that this guy will do anything for money, even if it is putting himself through pain, facing death, all the above. I mean, this is just an excellent, without using dialogue, setting up a character, as well as providing the scene and the setting as a character itself. I'm just now realizing how phenomenal these cinematographers and these directors have shot the openings of these movies. I mean, they're just terrific. And then finally, my bonus movie is 2008 Children of Men. And I've been raving about this movie a lot the past month. Alfonso Cuarón's Children of Men. It's based in the future when women cannot have children, but then all of a sudden this woman gets pregnant and the character that is played by Clive Owen is tasked to save her and take her to the land of opportunity, I guess, where she will be free from those that are trying to kill her and destroy her child. Now, Children of Men is the perfect setup for a sci-fi flick, kind of like Dark City. With Dark City, you have the opening narration, you have the setup, and it's basically saying, here you go. Here's the story, here's a brief synopsis, go enjoy it. Take the synopsis, what it is, and have fun. Again, Children of Men, excellent music, excellent suspense, and excellent cinematography as well as direction. My films for this 3 Squared are Drive, The Matrix, There Will Be Blood, and my little bonus movie, Children of Men.
Outstanding. Okay, well, that is an excellent 3 Squared. With a bonus flick from you, sir, I am going to go ahead and say we should jump right into the movies. Yes, the movies, the movies, the movies. So the movies, right, this week's movies are Man of Steel, The Paperboy, and Dogtooth, a Greek foreign film, which is probably why you haven't heard of it. What do we want to start with, Tim?
Let's jump into Dogtooth.
Yes. I cannot remember the name of the movie that I said this about before, but this for me was on a technical aspect level, in terms of the actual movie making that went into it, is a good movie. I thought that the direction was done, the acting was well done. I really enjoyed the cinematography. I thought it was really, really cool. This movie is from 2009 and is designed in every way, shape, or form, including the footage used to look like it's from the very early to mid-80s. And I thought that was all super, super duper cool. But what we have here is a married couple who, for reasons unknown, have isolated their children into believing that they are living on some idyllic compound. And it's not like this seems to be a pretty reasonably well-sized home with a nice big backyard and a pool, and it's just got like a 10-foot walls all the way around it, and Dad is the only one who ever leaves and goes to work at a factory where he is an executive. They don't really go into what he is doing. But yeah, so I guess he makes enough money to support this lifestyle. And they, for whatever reason, have decided that their oldest, there's 3 kids, an oldest daughter, a middle son, and a youngest daughter. And they feel that the boy is reached sexual maturity or whatever and needs to get his fuck on. So they blindfold a security chick that the dad works with, and he's basically paying her like a prostitute, you know, hey, come on. And she's totally down with this because, you know, I guess she has scruples. And because of the introduction of this chick, their little idyllic world falls apart. You get no payoff for all this shit that you're watching happening, and you get no explanation as to why any of this is happening. And for those two reasons, this movie gets 2¾ stars, because I hated the way that the movie played out. I did not feel satisfied by the reasoning for the movie existing, yet the performances were really good, and the acting was really good, and the direction was really good, and the dialogue in and of itself was really good. It's just the story is gonna leave you going, what the actual fuck? And that's pretty much where it's gonna start off that way, and you're gonna end that way. And I'm not gonna give this thing away I don't know why I'm not gonna give this thing away. Maybe because I just don't, so we don't have to talk about it as much. But I really, you know, this one's on Netflix. so you can stream it if you want, but don't say I didn't warn you. And now with Tim, with the unbelievably amazing viewpoint of this movie. Carry away.
This movie is so well made that you don't really have to know why the parents are doing this. I mean, you can use your imagination and whatever reason you can think of, whether the parents might have had a horrible experience growing up. You know, you can just make up anything and basically you'll be right. You're looking through a window onto this family, and it's only for a short period of time. A week, I forget the time frame, but it's only for a short while. And the movie ends how it should end. It's not a happy ending. For some people, it's an unfulfilled ending because a lot of people have got to, they've got to have an ending. But, you know, how else was the movie going to end? Obviously, this girl is not going to escape. So, of course, she gets, spoiler alert, of course she gets into this car that her father drives to work every day. She gets into the trunk and she hides there. And the camera stays on the trunk for maybe, I don't know, a minute and a half, 2 minutes. While he's
not that long.
Okay,
it's like
30 seconds. I'll say about 30 seconds. While the father's going into work, and you just you don't know if she's going to open up the trunk or not. Well, of course she's not going to open up the trunk. Well, one thing, I don't believe that car has an emergency hatch to open it up in the car.
And again, that's why I loved, again, like on a technical level. This is supposed to take place in the early to mid 80s. So no, there's no way that thing had a latch. She was going to have to wait till somebody opens that trunk before anything could happen.
Right.
And I will say this, that this movie, for the story of the movie, I cannot deny that this is an amazing aspect to this movie. I cannot deny. Is this shows you just exactly how fragile the human mind is.
Right, exactly.
And how tenuous the grasp of reality is for anyone, and how easy it is to manipulate.
Right. And story-wise, I just loved how you see humans at their most primitive. I mean, these are basically young adults that are basically children. Young children. I mean, I wouldn't say mentally, probably past the age of a toddler, even.
Nah.
Well, I mean, they do.
These are clearly kids who are late teens at the worst. Probably really getting about 20. I would say the youngest kid is probably 16, 17.
Well, right. Yeah. Well, I mean, young adult.
And their mental age, I would put their mental age in terms of cognitive grasp at about, overall, all of them, probably about 15, 16.
I would honestly say that when I mean a toddler, I mean they're being force-fed false information. Like what to call, I forget specifics, but for example...
Oh, the C? They call the C a C, like the chair.
Exactly.
Zombies, the yellow flower.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. That like they said, well, what's this? What's a zombie? Oh, the zombie. The mother tells the kid that. Oh, the son. Yeah, a zombie is a small yellow flower. And they do all that. I mean, they can't fully tell what is what. I mean, they have an explanation for things, but it's not the correct explanation.
I don't know. It seems like everybody's praising this movie for doing exactly what M. Night Shyamalan did in The Village.
I think it's completely
because those kids
those
were
two.
All lied to. Everybody thought they were living in the 1800s.
But this is more realistic. It's also a playoff of homeschooling, how parents are controlling into what their children learn, especially when it comes to homeschooling. The parents have, or whoever is doing the homeschooling, they have the ability to teach their kids whatever, to keep the kid from learning whatever. And then this movie, it's basically showing these young adults, showing human beings at their most primitive, at not knowing, at coming up with the reasoning and coming up with explanations all on their own that are more than likely probably 80% completely false and based on lies told by their parents. I think the characters are phenomenal. I loved how the characters also progress, how they're starting to learn things and how they're starting to pick up on certain things, how they're maturing. The son is becoming a man. He's experimenting in sex, even though it's very weird and not right whatsoever, because he goes from doing the security guard that his father hires to doing his sister. Which, I gotta say, I went and saw it at the Quentin Tarantino movie theater, the New Beverly Cinema that he has right down the block. Did Netflix, blur out anything? Because there's a scene where the sister is giving him a hand job, and you actually see her do it.
Oh yeah, no, you got to see him. You got to see him do it. You got to see his erect penis start to rise above his leg.
Oh, you actually see that on Netflix? Oh, wow.
Oh yeah.
Wow. So it was just cool to see how the characters grew up in this short period of time and how their maturity starts coming into play, like with exploring violence, with exploring sex, with exploring questioning their parents and questioning things. It's also creepy seeing how the father, who is a phenomenal actor, I'm going to go ahead and quickly note that most of the actors in this movie are non-professionals whatsoever. I believe two of them, or a handful of them, were doing theater or something like that. But most of these performers are not professional screen actors whatsoever. So they did perfectly. They all acted well together. It was just a phenomenal cast. And what I was saying a little while ago is that the father, it's just amazing just seeing the scenes where he just completely loses his shit and goes ballistic. And beating up on the daughter, beating up on cop that he hires to have sex with his son, who in turn gives these movies to the eldest daughter to watch. And they're not allowed to watch movies, so she's watching Jaws. And she starts quoting Jaws and starts like in playing out the movie and learning things from the movie. And that furthers the character. So it's just phenomenal. Just seeing them like going from the primitive aspect, again, primitive, to a more lively group of people, if that makes any sense. The movie also shows the strangeness of a perfect family. And I'm doing what Matt likes to do, the air quotes with perfect family, air quotes. To whereas you hear about these picture perfect families and how what they look like on the outside on the photograph, but it could be a totally different story in real life. Beyond the photograph, I guess. And this kind of shows the strangeness of it, because this guy, on the outside to his work buddies, is a good guy. People see pictures, I don't know if they see pictures of his family, but they see pictures of his wife, and they think everything's hunky-dory. But really, this guy is ballistic. Him and his wife are controlling their kids, brainwashing them, and nobody knows about it. Nobody knows that he's a freak. So it's just bizarre. So in a way, this movie, along with the homeschooling aspect, is like a social commentary in some way. This is modern filmmaking at its best. I loved how they showed the widescreen compositions. You'll see often two characters in one shot, hardly ever three characters in one shot, and they're usually not really centered. This is also a very memorable movie to me. I mean, this is definitely one of those conversation pieces. Dogtooth, I loved it.
All right, well then, okay, so I think we can safely sum this one up by saying I give it 2.75 stars based mainly on the unsatisfying ending and the unfulfilling reasons for the situation taking place. Giving credit to the story highlighting the fragile nature of the human mind and all the technical aspects being good. You, however, think it's just a really, really, really good movie all the way around.
I do.
Okay, fair enough, fair enough. So then let's move on to The Paperboy, which will be a nice bridge because this is a movie I think both of us hate.
It's so bad that it is so entertaining to watch.
I think for me, the biggest problem with this movie is that it's supposedly supposed to take place in 1969. And this was made, it's directed by Lee Daniels, stars Matthew McConaughey, Zac Efron, Macy Gray, Nicole Kidman. It's got John Cusack in it as well. And it seemed to me that this was a movie that was made with the idea of what it was like in 1969 instead of what things were actually like in 1969. And I think that that's just the wrong way to start a period piece to begin with. And then from there, it just goes downhill. It's basically tripe, man.
It's a very stereotypical movie. I mean, it's filled with stereotypes.
So basically, I guess we should start here. The Paperboy, it's a 2012 American thriller film. And this is a movie about an idealistic reporter and his brother. They are investigating the events surrounding a murder because this woman, played by Nicole Kidman, who is super hot or whatever, is convinced that her lover boy that she fell in love with via being a pen pal in the prison system, that he's innocent. And then they're trying to explore this thing. And this is, of course, trying to tie into a coming of age story with a coming to terms of relationships within a family story, all interlaced in this thriller. And how people have to relate and love one another and Then, of course, you're also trying to put the backdrop of the late 60s, early 70s, where racial equality is really coming to the forefront. And let's just go ahead, and because that's all not complicated enough, let's throw closet homosexuality and masochism in the mix as well.
Which comes out of nowhere.
We're then going to go ahead, and again, this is after we're trying to make a movie about 1969 the way we think it should be instead of the way it actually was. And we're just going to have, and just for fun, we're going to have a really sloppy, sloppy mime scene of oral sex performed from a woman to a man. From a distance of about 12 feet. Was it about 12 feet, maybe? Probably a little less than that. Let's say 10 feet. Let's say, you know, they had a table between them. And
visions are coming in my head from that scene. It's...
And...
You saw the spunk in his pants, man.
Yeah, I have never... I don't typically feel uncomfortable. This was uncomfortable for me to watch, not because I cared this... It's because it's supposed to be making me turned on, and it's supposed to be making me a part, like you're watching it really happen. And all I'm sitting there thinking to myself is, this isn't doing anything for me. It's not turning me on. It's not making me involved in this movie at all.
It's creeping me the fuck out.
It's creeping me the fuck out. And the reason why it's creeping me the fuck out is because it's so piss poorly fucking done. I think if they had gotten, like, maybe, I don't know, an actual porn star to play Nicole Kidman's part, I might have had a better time with this.
You know, I don't know. I can't say it was her fault, because I think it was the direction. It was
Tim,
the direction.
How much longer can you stand there, or could you have the camera centered on her face, permanently paused in the bad O face from Office Space? But it's like stuck in the part. And you're how long are you going to sit there and stare at that and then not go, what the fuck are they doing?
I will say this. It does look like she is receiving the regurgitated food from a mama bird. If you were to freeze frame it, which I did not, but I mean, I'm kind of speculating that is what I would think it would look like. But I mean, it's also the actor, what's his name, is the criminal, is the bad guy.
Oh, John Cusack.
Yeah, John Cusack. So you think, John Cusack can play a great bad guy, and he's a southern bad guy, but the last thing you want to see is him jizzing on his thigh. It's not...
Jizz in my pants. Oh, we should, like, make a video where we put this jizz in my pants song over that scene.
Yeah, but it's like somebody walked by and spilt some water on his leg. That's how... Because, like, I didn't know really what he was doing until I think... I saw the spot, and I'm like, no, I think he's like sweating profusely on his inner thigh. And then I looked over at my girlfriend, and she's like, what the fuck are we watching?
That's the whole thing, is that they took a plethora of interesting ideas, and then they tried to mash them into something, into a box that was improperly made. And you end up with this. This is a jumbled mess. It was at least interesting. I was like, okay, I'm willing to stick around just to kind of see if Zac Efron ends up killing anybody by the end of the movie. He doesn't. It's kind of sad, because I would have liked to have seen him kill Nicole Kidman. I really kind of was hoping that was going to go there.
Right.
But they didn't. I'm just glad that you didn't like it either. So, this is a bad movie, and don't watch it.
Especially, it graphically shows Nicole Kidman peeing on Zac Efron on a beach. I mean, you have this beautiful beach, and the movie is shot wonderfully. I mean, I love the look of the movie, but the last thing I'm going to see is Nicole Kidman waving her naughty bits over Zac Efron's horribly wounded, stung body who got stung by jellyfish and peeing.
I'm pretty sure that Zac Efron had a crush on Nicole Kidman,
and that's why he did this
movie.
Life.
No, in real life. And they said, look, she doesn't want to do a movie with you. And he's like, I'll do anything. I'll do anything at all. And he's like, all right, you got to let her pee on your face. And he said, okay.
I'm pretty sure
that's how that contract negotiation went down. She was like, this little 20-something-year-old shit from High School Musical is wanting to do work with me. I'll do it if I can piss on his face.
Well, I think High School Musical is really the equivalent of getting peed on the face.
I don't know. And how about Macy Gray? Did not even see that one coming, huh?
I know. Just saying Macy Gray and movie put together, nobody would have saw that coming, especially back in the, 1997 when she was popular?
Yeah, when, you know, she tried to say goodbye and she choked. Clearly she didn't choke. They just shoveled the food down her face and she did all right.
Yeah, you need subtitles to want to listen to her, really. But yet when she sings beautifully. So I don't understand. You know, another oh shit moment, and by the way, this movie is filled with way too many what the fuck happened moments.
What? You're telling me you've never walked into a motel to see a man handcuffed and duct taped to his ankles to his thighs and, you know, fucked up the ass and beaten till his skull caved in on the right side? Come on, everybody's done that, right?
That was so random. I mean, because you didn't really know of Matthew McConaughey's character, which is Ward, being gay until the scene previous. Really? I mean, I can't think of any other time during the movie.
Oh, no, are you kidding? As soon as he walked up with Yardley
at the beginning,
and Zach, and then Macy and Anita, whatever, is it, and Ward never got with anybody unless he really had a reason to get with somebody. You know, he was tight. You know, basically she was saying that they were tight, they were like brothers, and she took it to be like they were brothers. But I knew at that point, nah, they've been fucking. Turned into just to be a blowjob. Apparently, that's all Yardley's admitting to.
It's just one after another. Every scene has a the shit ball son of a bitch am I watching? It is like it's laugh out loud hysterical, and the movie is not supposed to be. It's supposed to be, I think the movie's supposed to be a haunting, by the end of the movie, a depressing kind of movie.
Yes. But, and don't forget, it's also supposed to make you feel absolutely terrible about being white.
I know, and you know, and also in the movie, Zac Efron constantly stares off screen with his shirt off. Like, he hardly has a shirt on in the entire movie.
Yeah, and you notice he was sporting the briefs. He likes briefs. Or at least, we're going to pretend and say it's his character, but I think he likes the briefs.
I guess so. Nicole Kidman and the briefs. And also not really making any eye contact with anybody. Always staring off. I got a whole page of comments I gotta make. I mean, it's one of those movies that you have to say everything about it. Let's see. The awkward John Cusack and Nicole Kidman sex scene at the end. He licks her asshole. Wow,
what?
Yeah, he licks her asshole at the end of the movie. She's bent over. At the end of the movie, he's boning Nicole Kidman, John Cusack, when she ends up beating him alone when he gets out of prison.
Yeah, and they show
she's bent over, and he's all up in her badunkadunk, I guess.
Yeah.
You know, and I think porn is less offensive than that scene, to be honest.
Well, that's what you're going for. See, it's not like here, where you're like, why am I watching John Cusack cornholing Nicole Kidman?
It was definitely cornholing. If I would love to see somebody's reaction to watching that scene if they were actually eating corn. I would have vomited. It would have been horrible. You know, and I couldn't quite understand the character progression of why Nick, Zac Efron, why he loved Nicole Kidman. It just kind of seemed like he just loved her out of the blue. And it's not like he has a crush on this woman. He actually loves her. And that's something I never really understood. Matthew McConaughey, for the most part, does well. Usually in every Matthew McConaughey movie that Matthew McConaughey is in, he is good in it. Nicole Kidman, weird in this movie, but she did well. Unfortunately, their performances are overshadowed by the ridiculousness and awkwardness, even though Nicole Kidman was nominated for an Academy Award for this role. So I guess it'll take you taking a pee on a young man and getting your asshole licked by a sweaty John Cusack in Florida, as well as simulating air blowjobs to a convict will win you something. That and being mentally challenged is kind of a shoo-in, I guess. On a more serious note, this movie kind of has some similarities to Nabokov's Lolita. The professor has the love for the young girl who's underage and all this stuff. So I kind of see it, kind of the roles are kind of reversed here, where the young guy of age, but, you know, young guy falling in love with a woman. But the story doesn't work at all, because there's no authentic, mature dialogue to really drive any realistic feelings whatsoever. It doesn't really work for it being an immature love that Zac Efron has for Nicole Kidman, because the movie is just so stupid, and his thoughts and the shit that he says and the stuff he does is so immature that realism is kind of out the window completely. So you cannot buy anything. That is why by the end of the movie, when the love for her is completely destroyed, and shit happens to her, and shit happens to Matthew McConaughey, you just really don't care because you have no connection whatsoever. That is just weird. And that pretty much just sums up the entire movie. It is inconsistent and just weird.
All right, so then let's finish up with another fight. Time to pick a fight. Man of Steel, the 2013 Superman reboot, brought to you by the directing mind of Zack Snyder, with the production mind of Christopher Nolan, scripted by David S. Goyer. Starring Henry Cavill, Amy Adams, Michael Shannon in the primary roles, and for flashback roles, we have Kevin Costner, Diane Lane, and for alternate kind of universe computer dad roles, we have Russell Crowe playing Jor-El. Kevin Costner plays Earth Dad. Diane Lane plays Earth Mom. Lawrence Fishburne plays Perry White, which I kind of thought was funny because he's black. And this is the movie. It's essentially rehashing the first Superman from 1978, but in a very fresh and unique way. I have to say, going into this movie, I was super excited to see this movie. I thought that the way that they introduced Superman's origin story on Earth via the flashbacks, some people felt it was disjointed. I actually thought it was nice because it gave, the way that they did it for me, gave perspective on what you're about to view. It's like they set you up for a scene, give you the flashback, bring you back to where he is, and then he carries on and you've got a better understanding of what's driving him for that specific thing. I thought that the beginning of the movie was, I think they were trying too hard to separate themselves from the 78 movie. That as a result of them trying too hard, I think that you can tell they're trying too hard and it's not as good as it could have been. I want to say Michael Shannon is not terrible as Zod, but I think that he goes off the deep end a little too much. He's like the evil husband in Sleeping with the Enemy. Are you trying to provoke a quarrel? You will not quarrel with me! You know, kind of a thing. So he was a little inconsistent for me there. Overall, I thought he played a pretty good bad guy. I like that they made Lois Lane smart instead of just kind of oblivious to what's going on. And I really like that they gave you a clear and prescient manner of putting Lois and Clark together. And I really like the payoff at the end of the movie because of that. Downside to this movie is that it was a little bit too long. I think that the fight scenes, especially by the end of the movie, are ridiculously epic and deserve to be viewed on a big screen. I still think that even then, they didn't need to do quite so much on that. The end of the day, for me, especially given the fact that they were brave enough to have Superman kill somebody, he kills Zod, because Zod is about to laser I-beam some innocent civilians, I give this movie 3.5 out of 5 stars. This is definitely a better than average movie. It is not the best movie I've ever seen. It is not a movie that I would go out of my way to see again in the theater. I'm glad I saw it. I would recommend other people to see it. I will buy it when it comes on Blu-ray. But I am fully aware of its flaws and excited to see how it grows. There was a big discussion on Reddit about it because of a CGI'd cameo of Christopher Reeves in the movie, which was very, very tastefully done. If you don't know what you're looking for, you'd never, ever see it. And there's been one person who I think truly redeemed the story and what this film was trying to do. It's a Redditor by the name of TareXMD, T-A-R-E. And TareXMD says, "I thought it was incredible. The Kryptonian background of the story builds up for a whole DC universe amazingly well. Zod is not just some egomaniac who wants leaders to kneel before him. The line is cool, but it's missing for a reason, and take over the world. No, he's been bred as a leader and defender of Krypton, and that is the function he wants to maintain. Kal-El's upbringing is everything I wanted it to be, and logically leads to the man we see at the end. Lois is not a clueless bitch, she's actually a smart investigator for once. Her importance to Kal-El as the only person in the world who truly understands him, other than his mother, is what I love the most about her character and their relationship. It's why she's unique to him. The interactions with the military were very realistic, in my opinion. It's a Superman movie, so we should expect punches, which we got aplenty. The fact that Clark has never fought before is very evident throughout all the action sequences. The action was the best I've ever seen in a superhero movie, period. Snyder showed commendable composure, eliminating slow motion from almost the entire movie, especially in the scene where Feyora takes out the soldiers one after the other. The movie sets up for a sequel very well. Lex Luthor will definitely rise as the city's financial savior and will build upon the public's distrust of the alien after all the destruction. Will he pick up Zod's shed armor? Will he use the embryos on the Genesis ship? Will he harvest kryptonite from the Indian Ocean and make Metello? Will he use Superman's blood sample to make Bizarro, or the ship's AI to make Brainiac? The possibilities are all laid there. Loved it. That is what TerrorXMD had to say from Reddit. And I think that that is a very succinct way of saying that it was a good movie, could have been better, definitely worthy of getting a sequel, which we're going to see based on the news from earlier, and not a mindless brain fart that you should hate. But with that opinion, I give you Tim.
Okay, so my first introduction to the Superman mythos was not with the comic books, but it was with the Christopher Reeve movies, especially the first and the second one featuring Zod. Terrence Stamp as Zod. And then over the years, especially with Superman Returns, Bryan Singer's Superman movie that came out 6-7 years ago, I started reading more into the comic books, into the comic character itself, and what really makes Superman Superman. And exactly how Superman differs, not only from all comic book characters, but how he differs from other DC characters like Green Lantern and Batman. Superman is a symbol of hope. Superman is a god. He is from a land of people that on Earth they have superpowers. They fly, they have these heat beams coming through from their eyeballs to pierce any metals and cut whatever in half. Unbelievable strength. He can run faster than a speeding bullet, faster than a locomotive. So this guy can crush anybody. He could kill any thug, any human bad guy. Yet, Superman doesn't do that. Instead, he says, I want you to learn a lesson. You can be better people. You can be better citizens. You don't have to be bad guys. You can be good. So even though I have all this power, I'm not going to crush you. Instead, I want to teach you. I want to be your savior. And with the Christopher Reeve movies, you have that aspect. You have the dorky, goofy, kooky Clark Kent working in Metropolis at the Daily Planet. Throws on, takes off his glasses, puts some grease in his hair, and then all of a sudden, he's Superman with a cape and all that good stuff. Man of Steel is, I don't want to say drastically different, but the world that they create and the Superman that they create is very different from the original comic books, as well as the Christopher Reeve and the Bryan Singer Superman movies. And I love Zack Snyder. I do love Zack Snyder because of one movie that he has done that I think is the best superhero movie, the best comic book movie, and one of my favorite movies ever made, and that was The Watchmen. With that movie, he had the tone, he had the use of the music, he had a slow motion that he's known for, he has the visuals, he has the storytelling from source material, he just does everything perfectly. Because he had a great platform to build this movie on. With Superman, you have a script that was made by David Goyer, who worked with Christopher Nolan on the Batman movies. Christopher Nolan produced the movie, David S. Goyer also produced the movie, but he was basically the sole writer of the movie. So with this movie, like Matt was saying, they weren't really trying to copy the original movie. They're trying to make something pretty much completely different. They're changing the Lois Lane character. They're changing the Superman character. Superman isn't the dorky, gooky, the dorky, kooky, bumbling goofball that Christopher Reeve plays him. or had played him, or instead he's a good-looking guy who's down and out. He has these powers that he doesn't know what to do with, and then he kind of falls into becoming the Superman character. However, when he becomes Superman, it's as a result of shit is starting to kind of happen. Zod's coming down to Earth. He's wanting to destroy Earth and make Earth Krypton. But Superman is new to all of this. He's new to the origin of his powers. He's new. He doesn't know really how to use his power. He hasn't really crafted it well. And yet, right off the bat, he is thrown into this battle. One of the themes of Superman, the early Superman at least, is hope. In this movie, you know, it's hope. Hope trumps evil. Hope trumps darkness. Obviously, Superman is this god to all of us. Therefore, he is our savior, at least to those of Metropolis or in that universe. So General Zod comes around, and they have this big, epic battle. This battle, spoiler alert, major spoiler alert, completely demolishes the city of Metropolis. Now, how the hell, this is from a movie perspective, how the hell can you top that? Especially from a superhero, sci-fi action, CGI point of view, how the hell can you top that? I mean, right off the bat, from the first movie, the entire city is demolished. And not only that, this is a battle between gods. Why is it happening on Earth? This is something that should have been taking place on, like, up in space, or somewhere else to where people didn't die. Because it wasn't just like, you know, a few people died because of a boulder or because of a car crash or something like that. I'm talking about an entire city just completely in ruins by the end of the movie. And whenever they have their final battle, you know, it's amidst the rubble and amidst the ruins of buildings, and there is no Daily Planet, there is no this, there is no that. Which I guess, with kind of like Matt was saying with the Reddit thing, can set up the Lex Luthor and everybody being in Lex Luthor's debt because he is the money guy and he's the one that will more likely build up the city again. But still, I mean, something horrible has to happen in the second movie for it to even top the events that happen in this movie. I mean, that is kind of the main issue I had with it. On top of that, there is just way too much movement in the movie. Like, I haven't had a look away from a screen in a while. I mean, to be honest, I can't really think of another movie that I had to look away from the screen so much. I mean, there were probably about like 9 or 10 moments where I had to like stop what I was, you know, stop looking at the movie, turn away from the screen, close my eyes for a minute, and then go back to watching it. And it was the still same action scene. I mean, the movie is just constantly moving forward. It doesn't stop and really build anything. And I think a lot of that has to deal with the overproduced score, with Hans Zimmer's overproduced score. Hans Zimmer is known for the Chris Nolan Inception movie with the music that's just and just like this very violent, in-your-face music. And this is that music pretty much throughout the movie. Unless you're looking at something that's magical and serene and then the music changes. But when the action is going on, it's nonstop music. So the music is just overproduced, and to me it just ruins the entire movie. Well, that's not just the only thing, but it just, we have the storyline competing with the music, with the acting, with the character progression. When a movie doesn't really work together, the movie can't really go anywhere, it can't build. As well as with Zod. So there's really no character progression for him. I was a theater student for a long time, for a while, and one of the fundamentals of theater, of acting, was that you have to play with levels with your character. You cannot start at the top. Your voice cannot start in a yell because you can't build off from yelling. You cannot enunciate anymore. You cannot punch certain letters. Whereas if the character just starts off upset and just talking and then enunciating and then building up to the yelling and the screaming and the complete outbreak, it would create more depth and more meaning to what the characters have to say. And in this, I'm referring to Zod. It will give more depth to the character. And so when he is being angry or getting angry, you can feel his anger and understand his anger just within the dialogue. The fight scenes drag on. It's one fight scene after another. Basically, each big scene is separated by flashbacks, whether if it's with Jor-El or with Clark Kent and his step-parents, with Kevin Costner and Diane Lane. So the idea of the movie is that hope trumps darkness and evil, but Superman never experiences any real devastation and evil until close to the end of the movie, like the last section of the movie, when all the real stuff is going on. I mean, everything happens so fast. I mean, you have all this stuff going on. You can't really focus in on the character. And I think, to me, it takes away from the emotional side of Superman or Clark Kent, because you have all these explosions going on. You have devastation happening. You have this going on, that happening going on. You have focusing on the military. You have focusing on Lois Lane. There's just no balance to the action with the characterization and the depth. The balance, to me, is off. And with that, it takes away from the joy, the fun from the movie. There's not a lot of humor. I mean, because everything, there's so much that is forced, and it just takes away from the joy. It takes away from the playful rhythm that the entire, I'm not saying the entire film has to be playful, but there's aspects of Superman that is playful, that is cheeky, that is lovable, that there's just something about Superman that separates him from all the other superheroes. And yes, you do see that about him at the end of this movie, but to me, it just wasn't enough for this to justify him as Kal-El, the Earth God, the Superman, the peaceful man that will bring an end to evil as Metropolis knows it. So before I rant on any more about this movie, I will say that I did not enjoy it. The movie just kind of drug on, kind of like this review, just kind of drug on, didn't really do anything for me, kind of like The Amazing Spider-Man. I mean, it's kind of like nothing new, nothing entertaining, didn't really bring anything to this particular franchise.
Well, then I guess that brings us to the close of yet another show. Next week's Three Squared, Roland Emmerich movies. Since destruction and death and mayhem seems to be all over this episode, next week's Three Squared is going to be all about Roland Emmerich, our favorite Roland Emmerich films. The movies for next week are all going to be theater movies, World War Z, Monsters University, and White House Down, which we're going to, just for kicks, compare to Olympus Has Fallen and see what the similarities, differences, how good one is over the other. So it's technically four movies, but the official movies are World War Z, Monsters University, and White House Down. Other than that, is it time for the spiel?
Spiel on, my friend.
Outstanding. All right, the music you've been listening to, as always, has been provided to us by our music partners, Cries of Solace. You can find them at criesofsolace.com. You can also check them out at Reverb Nation, MySpace, and facebook.com/criesofsolace. As far as us, you can check us out too. Just go to slscast.com. You can also check us out on Facebook by going to Facebook and searching the SLS Cast. You can even send us email. You can send us email to the SLS Cast. You can also follow us on Twitter at the SLS Cast, and you can even subscribe on iTunes. So until next week, this is Matt saying, I really don't know. I should probably come up with a catchphrase. And Tim?
Cheers, guys.
Thanks again for listening to the SLS Cast with your hosts, Matt and Tim. Remember that you can find us at slscast.com, at the SLS Cast for Twitter, also on Facebook, and you can always subscribe on iTunes. Thanks again for listening.